The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Good music is what we want to hear.
What do you mean, good music?
It's what we dance to, what our children will dance to. And if you don't want to play it, then take your records and go home.
Did you have a band? Good or bad?
It's a great band. It's a bad band. It's like pizza, baby. It's good no matter what. There's music in the air.
Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis, the pop music critic at the Chicago Sun-Times.
And I'm Greg Kotz. I write about rock and roll for the Chicago Tribune. Today on the world's only rock and roll talk show, Jim and I are going to welcome agit-poet and rocker Saul Williams.
Plus, we'll review the new album from the indie pop band Los Campesinos, and then it's Greg's turn to add a track to the Desert Island Jukebox.
You are listening to Sound Opinions, and now it's time to welcome our newest affiliate.
Yes, Greg, it's time to welcome WHDD-FM in Sharon, Connecticut. We always like to greet a new station by playing some rock and roll from their area. In the case of Sharon, Connecticut, nearby is Lakeville, which is home of the Hotchkiss School, which produced one of the most important figures, I think, in music in the 20th century.
Absolutely. Imagine 20th century music without John Hammond, one of the great talent scouts. I think it would be a very different place. He brought a number of artists to the fore ahead of their time. In other words, he was a visionary guy. He saw the talent and he saw the way these people could change music before people around them did. Brought people like Benny Goodman and Count Basie and Billie Holiday to the fore in the 30s and 40s. And then generation after generation introduced Robert Johnson to a legion of rock and rollers in the early 60s by releasing his early music and blowing the minds of people like Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones and John Lennon of the Beatles, putting out the music of Aretha Franklin and Pete Seeger, signing Bob Dylan. It was called Hammond's Folly at Columbia at the time. And this guy with this voice, you're going to sign him?
He can't sing.
He can't sing. Lo and behold, Bob Dylan influencing another one of his signings, Bruce Springsteen, a decade later. And in honor of John Hammond and our addition to WHDD-FM in Sharon, Connecticut, let's play a song from Dylan's debut record, which was produced by Hammond, released in 1962 when Dylan was only 20 years old. Here's one of two original songs on that record. It's called Song for Woody from Bob Dylan on Sound Opinions.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing your world of people and things. Here, paupers and peasants and princes and kings. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a dying and it's hardly been born. Hey, Woody Guthrie, but I know that you know all the things that I'm a-saying and a-many times more. I'm a singing you yeah, this song, but I can't sing enough. Cause there's not many men who've done the things that you've done.
So
Song for Woody by Bob Dylan. Welcome to WHDD-FM in Connecticut. Greg, Madonna owns the candy shop, and she is charging top dollar if you want some sweets from her, at least on her coming North American tour. Ticket prices are expected to be $350 on the floor of the arena. That's not enough coin, not for Madonna. She has also cut a deal with StubHub.com, which proudly calls itself the leading secondary ticket reseller in the country. We've got Sean Pate on the line, the director of corporate communications for StubHub. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about this Madonna deal. She's the first major music artist who has officially embraced the secondary market on this official scale. What's the deal behind this deal?
Well, it's a really exciting deal, obviously, for us, and certainly a groundbreaking deal in the industry. Historically, the music industry has been a bit resistant to working with a secondary market company like StubHub, some for ethical and philosophical reasons, others just because of the stigma that's associated with it and some of the old schools of thought. But Madonna, being the trend-setting artist that she is and a very progressive thinker, has taken the leap to officially endorse us as that fan-to-fan ticket marketplace for her Sticky and Sweet tour.
What's in it for Madonna? What's the nature of the deal? I understand there's been talk about a flat fee to Madonna plus a percentage of sales. Can you give us some details about what exactly she's getting out of this deal?
Sure. I can't go into too much detail about the financial considerations, but there are financial considerations, obviously, and I think the Wall Street Journal captured some of those. Essentially that, Madonna is going to be, getting a piece of the pie, and that is something that a lot of artists in the industry have been looking at our market and figuring out, how can we work with or we would love to work with or get a piece of those profits that are being made from the resale of the tickets that are happening for even, sold out shows and shows across the country.
Sean, let me, there's a second side here to a lot of the language you're using. When you talk about secondary market, a lot of people in the music industry would prefer the term scalpers. StubHub is enabling scalpers to sell tickets at 4, 5, 6, 10 times the price that the artist originally set for them. Jam Productions, one of the largest promoters independently in the U.S. remaining, based here in Chicago, has been fighting scalpers for years. The state of Illinois actually has a very stringent anti-scalping ordinance, and they've been frustrated. They believe that the price that the artist originally charged is the one that should go.
Well, it's a really interesting argument, and certainly one that we've been talking about for many years as our business has grown and come into a lot of popularity. And really, when you think of the word scalping, first of all, why does scalping, that word, apply to tickets, for instance? And why does scalping not apply to, let's say, your real estate broker or the baseball card dealer or a stockbroker or an art dealer? Any of those particular items are often sold over the value that you paid for them originally, but they're sold at a market value. And so tickets are just the same and can be treated like a commodity.
Yeah, but Sean, we've seen scalpers or ticket brokers, if you prefer, use any number of nefarious means through the years, and this is well documented, to jump in front of the line, if you will. They have computer programs which besiege Ticketmaster with thousands of phone calls. Before that, they used to hire homeless people here in Chicago to stand in line. Scalping, I think, is a pretty justifiable name.
Right. Well, again, you have to think about the way that tickets are acquired today. And again, if somebody is building a business on acquiring tickets for resale, then they're going to certainly try a lot harder than the average fan who just needs 4 tickets to go with their friends on a Friday. And again, we're talking about the American capitalist economy. So you have to think about, in that dynamic, there are people out there that are going to see an opportunity, and those are the very small population of ticket brokers in America that literally buy to resell.
Sean, you got to make the case here. As the head of corporate communications of StubHub, I understand how Madonna makes out on this. She's going to be selling tickets for $200 to $300 at face value for this upcoming tour, I'm sure. The tickets have not been announced yet, but that was the case for her last tour. She's going to be able to now benefit of the resale of those tickets for maybe thousands of dollars. How is this good for consumers, though? I wonder how the concert goer is going to benefit from a business deal like this.
Well, there's a couple reasons. And one, I would say getting a ticket in this day and age is a difficult situation, regardless of the StubHubs of the world. We actually, I would argue, certainly are the solution to finding tickets. But if you think about it, people don't always know when a show is going on sale. They certainly, if they do know, they might not be able to get a ticket. And then when you get on to buy a ticket for a show, you literally have a limited choice of the best available within what you want to spend. And so there's so many different factors that work into that. When what Madonna is doing is endorsing a company that has been in business for 8 years and is really the most popular resale marketplace out there.
With Live Nation divorcing itself from Ticketmaster, Sean, what is to say that the next step is not a completely open market where there's bidding literally on every concert ticket? Do you see that scenario unfolding in the next few years?
You know, it's been something that's been discussed, and certainly in the industry, it's dynamic pricing and auctions and things have been dabbled with for many artists over the last few years. But I think in the large scale, when you talk about filling a venue of 15,000 to 20,000 seats, it's not practical to set pricing in a completely open market. What we do see more and more is that the premium seats in an arena is, the front 10 rows or, the choice views are now starting to escalate up to those premium levels. I'm looking actually at what Madonna is charging for her shows this coming tour, and the main floor is $350 for a face value. So that is what Madonna believes is a fair price to charge based on a number of factors.
Are we got to let you go, Sean, Director of Corporate Communications for StubHub? Thank you for being on Sound Opinions.
Great, thanks for having me, guys.
That is a rendition of U2's classic song Sunday Bloody Sunday by Saul Williams, our guest this week on Sound Opinions. Saul made a lot of news earlier in the year after releasing his Trent Reznor-produced album exclusively on the web. While he was out on tour with his band, Greg and I invited him to come by for an interview and live performance. We are here with Saul Williams, poet, rapper, actor, activist, hell of a fascinating artist. Thanks for coming, Saul.
Well, thanks for the compliment.
And a road-weary band, don't forget.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah.
Extraordinary album, The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Iggy Tardust.
Indeed.
Greg and I talked about it a lot when it came out as art and as a business story. Why don't we start with the business story?
Okay.
Because that's still in effect today. Working with producer Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails and collaborator, he co-wrote some of the material with you. You guys put it out on the net in a twist on what Radiohead did. Radiohead said, pay whatever you think it's worth.
Right.
You guys said you can take it for free or you can pay slightly more, a couple of dollars for a higher
$5
for a higher mm-hmm. fidelity version.
And choose which version you want. You could get it in FLAC. You can choose the bit rate. And we also included a 33-page PDF of original artwork done by Angelbert Metoyer, who's the artistic director of the tour and what have you. So, we found a way to embed our download with a lot more information.
260,000 people have downloaded The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Iggy Tardust since it came out last fall. And now 60,000 of those people have paid. One of the things that's really apparent from this total, that's twice as many as bought your previous album.
Thanks.
So those are pretty good results.
Full, only.
Well, that's the thing about when my last album came out. It came out at a time when the music industry was suffering in some ways more than it is now. So yeah, I sold less albums then. I'm not sure how many people I reached. Of course, now we artists have found a way to make our work more accessible and people seem to be more inspired to pay in certain cases. In our case, I would say that's been the case. It doesn't surprise me that the amount of people that have downloaded it for free. It makes perfect sense to me. I imagine that those 265,000 people, of them, maybe two of them heard of me before.
Well, it's instructive because I think, you know, absolutely, Saul, you don't have the name recognition that, say, a Radiohead does or a Nine Inch Nails, and they've had extremely successful attempts at doing the same kind of thing.
For a long time, and I'm pretty new to the scene, yeah.
But it's still, this is an incredible success. It seems to go hand in hand with the fact that you are on the road now. People can actually see it. They've heard about this guy. Hey, what's this all about? It seems like the shows are being very well attended, though.
Yeah, most of the shows, including tonight, last night, just about every single one has been sold out.
And the fact is that even if someone didn't buy it online, they're coming tonight and you're getting their $15 ticket.
Not only that, they're buying T-shirts, they're buying CDs, they're buying books, and they're also, I mean, I had this happen to me four times last night. I get all these kids who walk up to me and say, hey, man, I promised myself if I ever met you, I was going to give you this $5 because I don't have a credit card. So I have all these kids who are underage handing me $5.
Wow. That's pretty cool. So you've always got pocket chains.
Yeah, exactly.
So guys in the band, keep that in mind. He's buying every night.
You know, Jim, before we talk about the music, which is amazing, I think the best thing to do would be to have you guys play.
Cool. We have a song that's been crazy on the airwaves and TV right now because Nike decided to use it for their My Better campaign. It's called List of Demands. It's off my own old album, the self-titled one. And why don't we start with that, because it's a good way to get my voice jumping.
All right.
Cool, let's start it. The name of the song is List of Demands. Let's do it.
I'm down here drowning in your bed. You got me on my knees praying for everything you got. I ain't afraid of you. I'm just a victim of your fear. You cower in your tower praying that I disappear. I got another plan, one that requires me to stand on the stage in the street. Don't need no microphone to beat. And if you hear the song and you ain't dead, then sing along. Banging something that's hand drunk, so you'll get me over now. I got a list of demands laying on the palm of my hand. I want my list and you got no rise yet. We're living hand to mouth. You wanna be somebody, see somebody, find free somebody. I just took a man, getting on the palm of my hand. I bought my fist and you can know where I stand. We're living hand to mouth, hand to mouth. I wrote a song to you today while I was sitting in my room. I jumped up on my bed today and played it on a broom. I didn't think that it would be a song that you would hear, but when I played it in my head, I made you reappear. I wrote a video for it. And I asked how we fought. Then I took your picture out and take it to my heart. I take it to my heart, say girl, I take it to my heart. And if you fall away from me, you tear my life apart. I gotta listen to them. Sitting on the palm of my hand. I bought my fist and you got no right there. But live it hand to mouth. You wanna be somebody, see somebody, find free somebody. I listen to them. Sitting on the palm of my hand. I bought my fist and you got no right there.
Suffering, echinacea buffering. We ain't remember what we chose to forget. God's just a baby, and her diaper is wet.
Call the police, I'm strapped to the teeth, and liable to disregard your every belief. Calling the law, I'm fixing the jaw. Anomaly when it isn't seen to call up a brawl. Calling it now, cause it's about to go pow. I'm standing on the threshold of the ups and the downs. Call up a truce, cause I'm about to break loose. Protecting that concern, I'm breaking out of my new. I got a list of demands, written on the palm of my hand. I bought my fist and you got no right there. We're living hand to mouth. You wanna be somebody, see somebody, try and free somebody. A list of demands, written on the palm of my hand. I bought my fist and you got no right there. We're living hand to mouth. We'll be right back.
Great live performance of List of Demands by Saul Williams and his band on Sound Opinions. When we return after a short break on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media, Jim and I are going to talk to Saul about how that song was chosen to be used for a TV advertisement.
All been said and done. His completions won't complete me. I've divided me by one. I'm the answer to his riddle. I'm the caution of his wind. I'm the spoolage between tongue and teeth beneath his trembling grin. And I dare it my revision, for I dare not suffer twice. And I dare not reinvent the past, and I dare not be the Christ. And I welcome any sufferer, and I welcome any Saul, sitting in this room on wooden bench waiting for joy to call. And I suffer here alone, Lord, perturbed by my every thought. How I've tried to strip them to the bone, I've struggled and I've fought. Every jealous warped intention smuggled sewn into my jeans.
I want my money back. I'm down here drowning in your fat. You got me on my knees praying for everything you lack. I ain't afraid of you. I'm just a victim of your fear. You cower in your tower praying down.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. We're continuing our discussion with Saul Williams, who just performed this song, List of Demands. We asked the musician and activist about his controversial decision to sell the track to an ad.
I got a list of demands written on the palm of my hands. I'm on my fist and you gonna know why I stand.
What a great song. Nobody knew what was around in 2004. Now all of a sudden it's in your face on a on a gym shoe ad. Part of me saying, well, man, a gym shoe ad. The other part of it is me saying, some gym shoe ad executive really knows his music better than any radio programmer in the country.
I met him, yeah.
Obviously, you've made a reputation as being a guy up on his issues, an activist. What was the thinking that went into putting a song like that with an advertisement?
Well, it was real simple. You know, I was approached by Nike after they had already made the commercial. And they sent me an email saying, look at this. What do you think? Do you approve? And my thought was real simple. I know that a corporation the size of Nike, first of all, I've known for the past couple of years that they, like most corporations nowadays, have been trying to find a way to respond to all of the, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of worldwide complaints that they've been getting about the ethical treatment of workers and what have you. And so I knew that Nike was working on things the same way Adidas claims to be. Whether it's face value or something they're actually doing is up to them. But they have at least hired people to help them shift their companies. And like Walmart going green or McDonald's selling veggie burgers, they're all trying to shift towards something more ethical. My thought was pretty simple along the lines of a company the size of Nike, their sales don't fluctuate with their ads. People don't watch a Nike ad and go, oh, I got to go download those sneakers. But they do watch the ad and go, I got to download that song. And that's exactly what's happened. There's been no spike in Nike ads over the past 3 weeks, but there have been a spike in people turned on to my music, and thus, you know, not only my music, but since I'm labeled as, you know, a message person, turned on to what I think about, what I believe in through my writings, through my music, and what have you. And I also don't have the belief. I feel like a lot of my fans, some of them have this sense of, like, they believe that saying F you from the sidelines is the most powerful thing that you can do. Whereas I see it as kind of apathetic. I don't believe that the power of the corporations is more powerful than the power of music or the power of an artist. So that I believe that it's possible, just like Bono knows that it's possible, for individual artists to shift how executives, if I can inspire a student, I can inspire an executive. It's really that simple.
And the commercial essentially is a commercial for Saul Williams. It's hard to, you know.
It took me 10 views to figure out it was actually a gym shoe ad, because
exactly.
I was like, the song is amazing. You know, it's like, you want to go, where's that song? Like, you got to get the song.
At the end of the day, I feel like my songs sell one product, and that is to inspire a sense of self-empowerment in the listener, to get them to question the norm, to get them to question the role of music, the role of art, and the role that they can play in today's society. And even if, you know, a corporation such as Nike chooses to use my song, that's the product that my song will sell before it sells theirs.
In selling those things, Saul, you are a published poet. How is the song a more powerful tool to sell your ideas and your beliefs than the poem?
Well, it's because music, you know, transcends barriers that poetry alone often cannot, because of our own hesitation, you know, to give our ear, time, attention, focus to this abstract art form. And so for me as a poet, realizing, one, the music within my poetry, and then working towards bringing that out through music, through hip-hop, through rock and roll, through radio, through recordings, it does spread a message. But I have to be honest, that's not why I make music.
Right.
I make music because I like to dance, and I can't count on other artists to make music that I can dance to. You know, because a lot of people go on about my message and my lyrics, but if you listen to my beats, they're pretty different from other beats. And that's what excites me. That's where the lyrics come from, is the inspiration of finding these new beats.
Well, it's also creating categories. People love to put people in categories, and that's something that you've been fighting your entire career. I mean, you've been making music since the 90s, and
yeah.
You know, people see black urban artist who's a poet. Well, a rapper. You know, it's automatically kind of the stereotype that you're fit into, and I know that Rick Rubin, who's made a few pretty significant records over the last few decades,
yeah.
wanted to make a hip-hop record with you, and what he got was not a hip-hop record.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm the American born of beats and blood.
He had a lot of difficulty trying to understand what it was that I was trying to do. Of course, I had a lot of difficulty articulating that as well, because it was the first music that I ever wrote, and I wasn't really accomplished or didn't know anything about writing songs. So that Amethyst Rockstar contains pretty much the first songs I ever wrote, and he listened to that and just said, "These guitar riffs you're writing are cliche. Have you ever even listened to Sabbath? Have you ever listened to, you know?" And unfortunately, my answer was like, no.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had a lot of research to do. I had a lot of homework to do, and that's what I've been doing over the years. And my goal with my second album, the self-titled one that listed Demands and Black Stacey and Grippo on, that's the one where I was trying to reflect a lot of the homework that I'd been doing and focusing on songwriting. And then this one with Trent was really me feeling confident about where I am as a musician now.
Let's you want to play something from the new record to sort of illustrate that?
Sure. Is there anything you want to hear from the new record?
It's great stuff. The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardis. We're going to talk about the title and the significance behind some of the lyrics in a minute. But
I'm a huge fan of Convict Colony.
Convict yeah. Colony is a great track.
All right, let's go for it.
Colony, if you're running from the sun.
Convict Colony by Saul Williams from The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust. This is as fine a punk, metal, experimental rock, hip-hop, or soul band as we've ever had here. It's a four-piece group, guitar, keyboards, sampler, electronics, and a little tiny cymbal on a seriously big stand. Let me see if I get your names right, guys. It's CX Kidtronic, Kwame, Brent, Pierce, and Davin?
Devan.
Okay. You only have one intensity, and it's 100%. On stage, you know, when I talked to you a couple of weeks ago, and in the past you've said, you know, the goal of too much hip-hop today is to be cool. Everybody's cool. Your goal is very old-school punk rock.
I want to lose my cool. Exactly. That's exactly what I go for. Yeah, for sure.
You also reference in this work, obviously, an iconic concept record, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, 1973 Bowie record.
Yeah.
How did that figure into your thinking in creating this Niggy Tardust character?
Well, you know, the thing I like about Bowie, you know, we were listening to Hunky Dory today, and I was thinking about, you know, listening to the lyrics of Changes and you know, that whole, like, ode, like, watch out, you rock and rollers, because you're going to get old.
Ooh, look out, you rock and rollers.
And I was thinking about how Bowie found a way to transform his career and his art into something that challenged the media and inspired young people and inspired even other artists to rethink how they think of what they're doing and why they're doing and what have you. And he theatricalized it, but also raised questions in his case surrounding, you know, gender and sexual identity and what have you. And that's seen as the first concept album. So my ode to Ziggy through Niggy, I kind of thought, like, if I'm going to do a concept album, I'm going to give a shout out to the first concept album, the one that I know all these people love and adore, and dare them to say, what right do you have? You know? And so that was the first thing. But then secondly, it really is a beautiful shout out to Bowie, because he is an inspiration in that when I think of the challenges that I've had in my own career and him coming out as a folk artist initially, and the challenges that he faced in being boxed in this hippie sort of thing and going, nah, no, no. No, it's bigger than that. I really do relate to that transition and to theatricalizing it. That's my background. So in many ways, it just made perfect sense. Now, the difference is, you know, the rise and fall versus the inevitable rise and liberation. Mm. And that's where a lot of my political ideology comes in, you know, and my belief in the fact that the truth does prevail, you know, that it is inevitable that corporations become ethical with time, that governments begin to reflect the will of the people more so, that just with time we grow beyond the slavery of our past, we grow beyond our history, we grow beyond whatever we're born into, and begin to realize the role that we have, not as a race, which is a social construct, but as a species, as humanity, and realizing our role on this planet. I believe that that is inevitable.
Well, you tied it in with Bowie, you know, sort of attacking these ideas about what is gender, what is sexuality.
Yeah.
I mean, that album, you know, Bowie's previous album, he's appearing on the cover as, in a dress.
Yeah.
And it was shocking to people, you know.
I know. They wouldn't even put it in some stores where they banned the image, right?
Right. Yeah. So, Niggy, I take it as sort of your commentary on these race
all of these things and all the N-word. You know, stuff that's going on. Like, it was so, I was so excited that all the N-word stuff started going on as I was creating this Niggy Tardust album, because I thought that really the most beautiful thing I could do was to show how we could transform this abhorrent, horrible thing into something that actually makes you want to smile. Because it's true, the word nigger is horrible, but Niggy is cute. Undeniably. Yeah. You know, you want to be down with Niggy. You know, you don't want to erase that from me. You kind of like that.
When I say nigga, you say nothing. Nigga, nigga. When I say nigga, you say nothing. Nigga.
Shut up.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. We're here with Saul Williams and his band. How about another song, guys?
Yeah, Let's do Banged and Blown Through, y'all.
Conductor, conductor,
have the song in me.
Binged and blown through.
Excellent. Saul, thank you so much for coming on the show and bringing the band with you. You guys sounded great.
Thank you.
To share your sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media with a review of the latest from the multi-instrumental pop band Los Campesinos.
You're listening to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.
Beats, yeah, they were coming at the speakers and were winding up straight in your sneakers. And I'm dancing like every song is Princess Piss, or like all my dance heroes word if they exist. And yeah, it's sad that you think that we're all just singsters. And even if we were, it's not the scene you're thinking of. Just taking props from 90s boy band fashions or crop tops and testosterone passion. If there's one so I can dance a single step.
Greg, that is the track You, Me, Dancing from Los Campesinos.
You need the exclamation points.
You need the exclamation points. These guys are unduly fond of exclamation points. There's one after their name. There's one after every word in the title of that song, You, Me, Dancing. And also ellipses, because they have a new album, their debut album, and it's called Hold On Now, Youngster. See, ellipses are harder to do than exclamation points. If I'd gone to broadcast school, maybe I'd have learned these things. You played that song when we came back from South by Southwest. You were very excited about this seven-piece indie pop buzz band from Wales. I did not see them, so I am just judging them by this recording, which I have to say has more glockenspiel than any record since Jethro Tull back in the day. My goodness, you heard it there in that single. You hear it throughout this album. They are an orchestral pop combo. There is violin. There's all sorts of instruments. instruments. Everybody sings. The two main singers, I should also say that they all go by the name Campesinos, mm-hmm. just like the brothers Ramones. There's a woman, Alexandra, and a guy named Gareth. They are the main voices. Let's play a track from this album. And it, of course, has another exclamation point. Death to Los Campesinos from Hold On Now, Youngster, on Sound Opinions.
That is Los Campesinos with Death to Los Campesinos from their debut album, Hold On Now, Youngster. Yes, Jim, you are correct. I saw them at South by Southwest, and I love this band. It came at the end of an unusually slow night of music for me, and then seeing this band and seven people on stage who loved what they were doing. It got the whole crowd revved up.
Yeah, kind of like a triple espresso laced with Red Bull, right?
And that leads me to my review. I think that in order to appreciate this music, you need to be on something, preferably a lot of caffeine, preferably or some high sugar content energy drink, and it will suit your mood perfectly. If you are in a regular kind of getting up out of bed and kind of sleepy, kind of grumpy mode, this record may annoy you to no end. I put Gareth, the lead singer of the band, in the category of Einar of the Sugar Cubes and Fred Schneider of the B-52s as three most annoying men in rock. But I have to say, there's an exuberance to this band that I really, really love when I'm in the mood for it. These songs hurtle at you with a speed and a buoyancy that I love. I'm not going to parse the lyrics. I realize that there's a tremendous amount of pretentiousness in the lyrics,
yes.
But I am not listening for these lyrics. I saw a room full of people having a great time to this band. Glockenspiel or no Glockenspiel, this band rocks. And I have to say, the secret weapon in this band, I love Harriet Campesinos, the violin player.
No, you didn't say the exclamation point. Harriet Campesinos!
She adds a lot to this band, a lot of texture. I love this band as a live entity. This is a hit-and-miss record. There are some great songs on there, and not all of it works, but I'm going to give it a burn it on our buy it, burn it, trash it scale.
Greg, I'm going to concur with you. I give it a burn it as well, although I think you let them off the hook a little easily. I mean, we have to look at these lyrics because these lyrics are so inside baseball. You know, I mean, great pop music throws open the doors and invites everybody to the party. And when you're name-dropping K Records and Beat Happening and acting as if you're way cool because you know who those references are, and if you don't, you're not in our club, you're not welcome at our party, that puts me off. This music is so happy and so celebratory, I think it would be definitely a buy it record if I didn't get cheesed off every time I listen to the lyrics, especially on the part of Gareth Campesinos, because he's shooting to be like Eddie Argos of Art Brut or Jarvis Cocker of Pulp, but he's not nearly smart enough or deep enough. You know, maybe he will develop into that, and this might potentially become a really, really great band. It makes me angry, this record. It's an angry burn it.
It makes you angry.
Yeah, because I want it to be a buy it. There's no reason except for their own clubbiness that this should not be a buy it record.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
Remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Stranded, I'm
That sound can only mean one thing. It is time to pop a quarter in the Desert Island Jukebox. Greg Kot, what do you got for us?
Thank you, Jim. Our discussion of John Hammond at the top of the show got me thinking about the legacy that this man left. And we mentioned some of the big signings that he's had over the years, people from Count Basie to Bob Dylan to Bruce Springsteen. Everybody's heard of those people. But one of the signings that he made in the late 60s, I think, was one of the most intriguing of all, and that was Leonard Cohen, a guy who doesn't get enough props as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he's a recognized songwriter. His songs have been covered by numerous artists. Judy Collins put him on the map by covering his songs in the 60s. We've heard people like Jeff Buckley and John Cale and R.E.M. cover his songs. He's arguably more popular as a songwriter than he is as a performer. But I think there's nothing quite like the experience of hearing Leonard Cohen perform his own songs in that very distinctive monotone, sing-speak, baritone voice of his. And you have to wonder, again, when Hammond signs a guy like Cohen in his 30s, a published poet, you can imagine the people, the executives in Columbia Records going, what the heck are you doing? Who is this guy? He can't even sing. And yet, the prescience of Hammond's vision, I think, has been borne out over time. The body of work that Leonard Cohen has produced, beginning with his first record, just remarkable. That first record inspired Robert Altman, the great director, when he made this fascinating movie. Ever hear, ever see McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
Oh, yeah.
Kind of an anti-Western.
Mm-hmm.
And Cohen's music is all over that soundtrack, and it really sets the tone for that movie. Cohen's first record, Songs of Leonard Cohen, I think is one of the great debut albums of all time. It was made in his when Cohen was in his early 30s. Hammond started to produce the record, got sick, so it was taken over by John Simon, who was just coming off working with the band and Simon and Garfunkel. Simon added some cool touches to the record, but it's really the center of this is Cohen's voice and those amazing lyrics and his guitar playing. Here's an example of what I'm talking about, the song Sisters of Mercy. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
All the sisters of mercy, they are not departed or gone. They were waiting for me when I thought that I just can't go on. And they brought me their comfort, and later they brought me this song. Oh, I hope you run into them, you who've been traveling so long. Begins with your family, but soon it comes round to your soul. Well, I have been where you're hanging, I think I can see how you're pinned. When you're not feeling holy, your loneliness says that you've sinned.
Stem. Sisters of Mercy by Leonard Cohen on Sound Opinions. Good choice for the desert island, Mr. Cott. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to unearth some buried treasure, some great songs that you may not have heard of, but you can't live without.
As always, we have some thank yous to say. The performance by Saul Williams was recorded by Mary Gaffney and Sarah Toulouse. Our production team at Sound Opinions is Todd Bachman, Jason Saldana, and Robin Lynn. And our executive producer, Tori Southside Malatia, from henceforth shall have exclamation points in his name. So it's Tori Southside Malatia.
We weren't lovers like that, and besides, it would still be all right.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline, 1-888-859-1800.
Come on and answer your phone. Pick up the receiver. I know that you're at home.
New messages.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Aaron from Chicago, calling to give a second opinion on your diagnosis of Joel. I think this is really indicative of what's wrong with the American medical system. Most doctors just don't seem to listen. Joel said that he wanted to rock out and you prescribed Sparkle Horse. I think that pretty much borders on malpractice. So I have three alternative prescriptions that are both grounded in American roots music and can still rock your socks off. The most obvious prescription would have been Modest Mouse, I think.
Fire it up, fire it up. When we finally turn it over, make a beeline towards the border. Have a drink, you had enough. Fire it up.
A couple lesser known ones would be Murder by Death from Bloomington, Indiana, or Odeth from Brooklyn. Thanks a lot for the great work.
Hi, my name is Nicole. I'm from Washington, Illinois here, and I just have a comment about the segment you just put on about the gentleman needing something that rocks but still has roots. Something to match up a little bit with the White Stripes would be the Black Keys. Same general, but they rock so much harder.
Hey, this is Josh from Chicago. I actually have a bone to pick with Melissa from Brooklyn, who called a few weeks back, bashing the fact that you guys put the Pixies on your Desert Island jukebox.
I feel like the Desert Island pick is your opportunity to really introduce people to something remote and special and something that they would never, ever come across.
She's missing the whole point of what the Desert Island Jukebox really is. It's songs that you can't live without. It's not about being a snob and being like, oh, I can't live without these songs, and you've never heard them. It's not about opening eyes. You guys do plenty of that during the show, and I can't thank you enough for that. And keep up the Desert Island Jukebox. You're going in the right direction, and I love the songs that you're playing.
Guys, this is Nate in Brooklyn. You know, as much as I respect Laurie Anderson's body of work and her vision as an artist, she unfortunately falls into that trap that a friend of mine coined the number one fan theory. She referred to New York as a Disneyland, as if now that there aren't heroin vials and bums occupying Thompson Square Park, great art is no longer possible. It is a fallacy of logic to presume that the former, grittier, dirtier, more dangerous New York was somehow more conducive to better art. I say open your ears, open your eyes, wake up. There is great art and there's great artistic culture in New York now. And of course, the now is always the best time to be alive. Great show. Thanks. Bye.
Captain says, put your head in your hands.
Hi, my name is Stu and I'm calling from New York City. And I can't believe you guys sometimes. You did your review on the new Elvis Costello album, and you're saying you want him to do another album like this year's model. So basically, you want him to be a one-note wonder. You want all his albums to be exactly the same. And then you complain about acts that are all one-note wonders because reviewers will complain that, oh, gee, he's making the same album over and over again. So you can't have it both ways. Anyway, we love the show. We listen all the time. Bye.
No more messages.
To give us your opinion on sound opinions, call our hotline, 1-888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with sound opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media.